the title is The Scale-Dependent Growth of Structure in Variable FOVR Theories. So I will be talking about linear perturbation in models of FOVR theories. And let me start by saying that the work I present has been done in collaboration with my advisor, Matt Roden, with Levon Pogosyan, Rachel Bean, and David Bernat. In particular, most of what I will talk about is work done with Levon. So the underlying, the underlying idea is that there is compelling evidence that the expansion of the universe is accelerating, and we don't know what is driving this acceleration. So could it be modified gravity? But the next interesting question is, well, okay, if it is modified gravity, when we distinguish it from a cosmological constant or more conventional dark energy model? And the answer seems to be that we need to move to the level of perturbations. There is a sort of degeneracy at the background level. So studying large-scale structure is what we want to do to probe gravity. And for the talk, I will concentrate on FOVR theories. In particular, for these theories, I will review all the conditions that we need to satisfy in order for the models to be viable at the background level. And the result will be that basically, if you want to satisfy, to have a viable expansion history and to satisfy local constraints of gravity, we are reduced at models that mimic closely the cosmological constant. Then I will study how structure grow. And we will see that there is a change, significant change in the dynamics, and the modifications induce a very characteristic scale-dependent pattern, even for models that at the background level behave exactly like a cosmological constant. And then I will conclude. So, very briefly, we all know that there are many independent evidences for the acceleration of the universe. If we combine data from supernovae, from cosmic microwave background, and large-scale structure, and we try to fit them using standard general relativity applied to a homogeneous and isotropic universe, then we conclude that, let me assume there is cold dark matter, so then we conclude that matter, baryons, and cold dark matter makes up just 30% of the energy budget, of the current energy budget in the universe, and we need some smoothly distributed component which makes up 70% of the energy budget and has a dynamics such that to give the acceleration. And indeed, a very good fit to all this data is the cosmological constant, in which, so the model lambda CDM, in which besides assuming cold dark matter, we assume also that there is a constant. This fits very well all the present data, although it's interesting to try to explore other possibilities and see if they could fit the data as well and give testable features. So cosmological constant might be thought as a specific model in a broader class that we could dub dark energy models, in which basically we try to solve this puzzle of acceleration by changing the energy budget of the universe, by changing the components of the energy momentum tensor. And then in a very rough classification, we could say another approach could be instead, well, let's change the left-hand side of the Einstein equation. Let's try to modify gravity and see if that's what could give us acceleration, even just with matter in the universe. So modifying gravity, we can do that in many ways. And for example, I didn't know you were here when I swear. So for example, one way to go is that the Friedmann equation is the one describing the dynamics of the universe, right? So we could act directly on that one and change the way the Hubble parameter depends on the usual, on matter. So that was, for example, what is done in the Cardassian model. Or we could try to work in extra dimensions like the Dvalig-Abadadze-Porrati model and infer and modify four-dimensional gravity. And I believe DGP is what inspired a more recent proposal, that is the gravitation, in which you try to decouple the vacuum energy from gravity. Or we can think to act directly on the four-dimensional action for gravity and change it in a covariant way. And that's what, for example, is done in model of FOVR or FOVRPQ, where we add function of the curvature invariance. Typically, what happens in this model is that you free up some new degree of freedom. You have extra dynamics. So it's interesting to try to modify gravity without introducing any new dynamics. And that, for example, is done in the, in the Cascaton model, in which there is a scalar field which is introduced, but at the end of the day it's not dynamical and changes the constraint equations of gravity. So we concentrate on this class of approaches, in particular on f of r theories. Anyhow, the more generic, the broader question is, as I said at the beginning, typically at the background level we have degeneracy between lambda CDM or quintessence dark energy and models of modified gravity. And we need to move to the level of perturbations to distinguish them. The new dynamics typically give us some richer behavior for the perturbations. And galaxy count, integrated Saxworth effect, and weak lensings are probably very interesting probe of gravity. So from now on, I will concentrate on f of r, going through the details of the background dynamics and then of the perturbations. So we know that f of r are described by the following action, in which, besides the Ricci scalar, we have the function of the Ricci scalar, f of r, indeed. We don't touch anything in the matter sector, so matter is still minimally coupled to gravity. So the equations, we have the Einstein equations that are changed. We don't change anything in the, for the conservation of the energy momentum of matter. But Einstein equations are changed in a way that they become higher order. In particular, from these terms, we see that they are now fourth order instead of the second order of standard general relativity. And we can see that also if we map, if we look at the trace equation. Typically, this equation in standard general relativity is a constraint that sets the Ricci scalar equal to the trace of the energy momentum tensor. You see here that it's, instead it is a dynamical equation. So the typical step at this point is to map to the Einstein frame. No, it's the derivative of f with respect to r. Thank you. Yeah. So typical step at this point is to try to map to the Einstein frame, because in that way it's kind of clearer, that like the new degree of freedom becomes clearer. We see that clearly that there is a canonically defined scalar field. And it's kind of easier, the equations are more treatable, maybe intuitively more understandable. But we can study all the dynamics and all the conditions for the viability and stability of the theories as well in the Jordan frame. So I'm sticking to the Jordan frame. And we can think of rewriting the trace equation as an equation for this field, the derivative f with respect to r, which is dubbed also scalar on. So we can kind of define an effective potential for this field. And the derivative of f with respect to r. F. Yes, I'm going to call that the scalar on, yeah. So this is basically, in this way, we introduce some sort of effective potential describing the behavior of this scalar on. And we can also calculate the square mass associated to this scalar on. And you see that it depends on the specific form of f of r. Now, if we are in a condition in which these conditions are satisfied, which basically means that the derivative f with respect to r is very small, and the second derivative f with respect to r is negligible with respect to the background curvature, which turns out to be true through all the expansion history of the viable f of r model, the mass square can be approximated by this expression. So at the end of the day, we see that what is setting this mass of the scalar on is the second derivative of f with respect to r. Yeah. No, it's just ordinary matter. Yeah. No, I'm like this rho and p are just for matter, like. Cold dark matter, baryons, radiation.
So this just said that the quantum wave length is much smaller than Humboldt radiation.
Sorry, which condition? So, okay, so we can associate indeed, okay, the quantum wavelength to this mass. And it's a quantity that we use
in the study of perturbation. So the cause.
Right. So why do you make that assumption?
This.
That this the one hand just the experiments.
It turns out that basically variable models need satisfy this condition. Otherwise, you don't have you cannot have basically variable expansion history.
Expansion is
driven. Yeah.
So it's not local.
Also, local. No. So the condition for
gravity, I
think. Yeah. Right. At the end of the day, it's the local constraint which are the toughest one. Yeah. Where it's the galaxy, actually. Yeah. It's the local constraint which. Yeah.
Yes, local test, especially affect F1 going to zero, which is the cap, you know? Your scattering is also the.
No, yeah, you need. There are some sort of two conditions, basically. Yeah, you need the F1 to be very small, and you need also the gradient of this F1, so basically, and that also be the condition of the second derivative of F1, we expect one. Yeah. Okay, so the fact that there is. This extra dynamics basically give us
enough freedom to reproduce any expansion history that we want. So one idea one way to proceed is we fix the expansion history, for example, to the one of a flat universe with matter, radiation, and with some dark energy, with an equation of state which can be dependent on the scale factor. Then once we do this, we know how the Hubble parameter evolves. We know how the Ricci scala evolves, background quantities. So we can, what we are missing is simply the functional form of F of R. So we can use the Friedmann equation to obtain a second order differential equation for F of R. So here I define as Y, basically the dimensionless combination of F of R. The Friedmann equation can be rewritten as the following one. So it's a second order differential equation for Y. We know all these coefficients are just the quantity that we find as soon as we fix the expansion history. And we know also this kind of sourcing term as soon as we choose how the dark energy has to behave. So we kind of can reproduce whatever history we want, but what are, at the end of the day, the viable models? So there are many different conditions that we need to impose. First of all, it turns out that in order to have a stable high curvature regime, or equivalently to avoid the scalaron become tachyonic, we need the second derivative of F with respect to R to be positive. So this means that the scalaron function, the derivative of F with respect to R, will be monotonically increasing function of R. Then the combination 1 plus FR is basically what rescales your Newton constant in these theories. So you don't want it to go negative. Moreover, if you combine early universe condition, like we want to go basically back, reproduce general relativity in the early universe, with the first condition of the derivative of F, second derivative of F with respect to R being positive, you are reduced at the scalaron, the function F of F, derivative of F with respect to R, to be negative and monotonically increasing function of R. These are the three conditions to satisfy, to have a viable expansion history, go through the right matter era, and so on. Then if you want to satisfy also local constraints of gravity, you need the value of the function F of R today to be very small. Like a recent paper from Savisky and Hu studied the solar system constraint and the constraints from the galaxy. And basically the result is that a first constraint that I can put is that the value of F of R today needs to be smaller or equal than 10 to the minus 6. And which is this is the fourth constraint. This condition is what puts the stringent constraint on the models. So we are reduced, after all, at having to pick models which behave nearly as a cosmological constant, which for the W effective describing them will be almost constant and equal to minus 1. It's basically you want in the inner part, you want to reproduce a high curvature solution. You want to go back to GR. But on cosmological scales, you have a low curvature solution. So you need basically the condition comes from asking that the value of f of r on cosmological scales, which is the one I'm constraining here, with respect to the value in the inner part, they cannot be that different. You need the gradient of that, because basically the change in that value is what is sourcing the potential that will give you a fifth force, will give you departure from GR. So they apply this both to the solar system, but the solar system wasn't actually at the end of the day put in the stringent constraint. It was coming from galaxy. Although I think it is, it depends on actually how you, on the evolution of galaxy. So I think they should study like this constraint to slightly change, because what they used to study the galaxy, the formation of galaxy and so on, was based on standard general relativity models like lambda CDM. So they say that the dynamics could be different in f of r.
Well, it should lead to slightly different values.
Can I see the previous slide for a second?
The previous slide?
Yeah.
This one?
No. I don't know. Anyway, so Sierpinski gave a talk in Florence where he was saying all these models are ruled out.
So I think he was worrying about particle production, scalar production.
I don't know.
Yeah, there is a paper.
Are you talking about
a specific model? So he was proposing a specific model. So I don't think he was really saying.
Yeah, but he was.
So he has two arguments.
Okay.
He's basically. One is they are both connected to the fact that it turns out that these models, at early times, there is the Ricci scalar oscillates very quickly and with big amplitudes. So he was saying that could lead to problems at the level of geodesics and at the level of scalar production. There could be an overproduction of the scalar. He's not specifically showing how this could be. And it seems that what is really what is the temperature metric, so probably the one that you're interested in after all, is the second derivative of f with respect to r times this oscillation in the times change in the Ricci scalar. And this is a very tiny quantity. So after all, this doesn't oscillate with significant amplitude. So maybe, and also if this is the scalar, it's described as a function of r, so the perturbation to the scalar can be basically written as this, maybe the amplitude in that sense is also negligible. So maybe it's not the problem. Though, yeah, I mean, I guess we need to do some careful calculation. But I don't think it was true enough. Definitely, you're saying that it's a serious problem. Yeah, I know that Sergei Vinitsky is exchanging emails with him, discussing about the details of this calculation to see if actually there is this problem of overproduction. So you need f, the derivative of f with respect to r. So from the first one, you see that the derivative with respect to r is monotonically increasing function of r, right? And back in the past, you want to basically reproduce standard general relativity.
Oh, I see.
So you really, so basically, yeah. Okay, so I guess I was here. So I was saying, yeah, so we need to conclude trying to satisfy all those conditions, we conclude that the viable models are those that closely mimic the cosmological constant.
So the natural question is, okay, can we distinguish them? And it seems that even those models give interesting prediction for the growth of structure. And we see that there is a particular announcement of the growth associated with the fifth force due to this extra field. And there is a particular slip introduced between the Newtonian potential. So it seems that, yes, large-scale structures are in an interesting probe of gravity.
Yeah, it could be on a very short scale,
yeah. Because I remember when you looked at that in the Canadian context, it was always in the
very
deep
small.
In the nonlinear regimes.
Yeah, actually, you are very close to that, yeah. I think, yeah. of the probably 10 megafarads. In this case, probably 10. So, yeah, indeed, in what follows, I won't give any specific number like numerical constraint, but look more at the qualitative behavior.
I mean, because let me ask, so what's the quantum wavelength today of that field in your model?
So, depends on the, so what basically, the last condition, this last condition, basically, plus combining constraint from the cross-correlation of ISW with galaxies, basically leads you to having a quantum wavelength today, I guess, down to the 10 over 10 megaparsecs.
Okay.
Which, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, we showed later on the behavior of the quantum wavelength. So there will be some numbers. So. Okay, so I'll concentrate on scalar perturbations and in Newtonian gauge. So the function describing the departure from a homogeneous and isotropic metric at this potential psi and phi, and then we have the usual perturbation to the energy momentum tensor. I'm going to concentrate for a while on the Einstein equations because those are the ones that change significantly. So one equation which is typically used in studying perturbation is the anisotropy one, which is telling us about the difference between psi and phi. We see that it's not zero, and it's proportional to the perturbation of the function of R. In particular, not only it is
not zero, so not only we have a slit between the potential, but this delta R contains dynamical terms. So it's not anymore a constraint equation, we have extra dynamics. And similarly, the Poisson equation, which tells us how the potential phi is related to the density here, it's commoving density perturbation in the matter field, is changed. It compared to the one in standard general relativity, which is typically a constraint, now we have all these new terms. So even this equation is dynamical. So typically in standard, like in models like lambda CBM, we just need to evolve the matter over density perturbation. Then from there, we can infer phi, which is equal to psi. Here we have extra dynamics. And the variables we choose to evolve are the following one. The combination phi plus psi, because we are interested in the integrated Saxo signal in weak lensing, so that's what is sourcing all these effects. And the shear, the slit between the Newtonian potential. So here capital F is the sum of 1 plus FR. I will use this combination. So basically, there is a kind of an effective shear sourced by the modifications, and we want to see how it evolves. So we can use the Einstein equation to rewrite them for as a couple order of first order, couple system of first order differential equation for phi plus and chi. And then we can combine them with the equation for the velocity field and the matter over density, setting some initial conditions and evolve them. So doing the numerical trick. And basically the initial the conditions that we choose is some sort of early enough time in order to set standard general relativity initial conditions, but late enough to neglect radiation. That's the choice of the redshift. And these are the standard initial conditions. So we basically set phi plus to minus one and kill modifications. And now, in these plots, I'm showing some results of the numerical simulation. So let me first tell you the model for which I'm plotting is an F of R model, which is given exactly a lambda CBM expansion history. So W is constant and equal to minus one. The value of the function today is 10 to the minus four. So we are two orders of magnitude bigger than what should be if we want to really satisfy local constraints. Oh, I don't have a function, a specific form. Like we rebuild it, so numerically we can see how it evolves, but we don't have a, yeah.
So, okay, the choice
is just in order for the effect to be more visible by eye, but qualitatively nothing changes if we go to a lower value of F of R today. So I'm plotting the behavior of the potential as a function of the scale factor for different scales. The solid black line corresponds to the scale independent behavior in lambda CDM. And then we have the black dotted line and these blue and red lines, which correspond to this scale. So you can see that the potentials we are used in lambda CDM to know that the potentials are constant during matter domination and start decaying when the background starts accelerating. And here we see instead that on larger scales, the decay is delayed, but even on smaller scales, there is some sort of enhancement and the behavior is changing to growth, temporary growth. It's interesting to see that the ratio of the potential phi and psi, which should be 1 for lambda CDM, starts off as 1, stay close to 1, but then starts departing to what is called the low curvature solution, in which psi is twice phi. And this kind of effective shear, the quantity that was sourcing the difference between phi and psi, is starting off from 0 and turning on to some constant value as a ratio to the metric potentials. So it seems that there is a peculiar behavior, and we want to understand this by doing some analytical calculations. So I'm going to move to sub-horizon regime. And typically in this situation, the equation for cold dark matter is now a second-order differential equation in which there is some sourcing term, which is just the metric potential psi. Now, what happens in lambda CDM is that we know we have all those constraint equations, the Poisson and the anisotropy one, and basically we can re-express this as proportional to delta matter. And the result is that you have a second-order differential equation in delta matter, which is scale-independent. That's where the scale-independent behavior comes from. If we try to re-express this in terms of delta matter in the case of the Fovar, we need to look at the Einstein equation on sub-horizon. The equations that I wrote before with the sub-horizon approximation can be rewritten as follows. And if we combine them, the sourcing terms is now proportional to delta matter, but there is this scale and time dependent factor in front, which is kind of rescaling the Newton constant. So if we look at this closely, you see that there is this combination FRR over 1 plus FR, which is setting some sort of transition scale for this factor in front of the of delta matter. And if you remember, it's just, here it's type, it should be a small r. It's basically the Compton wavelength of the scalarum. Capital F is 1 plus FR. And here I did its type of this r. This should be f, second derivative of f with respect to r.
Yeah, so, but so this one does nothing changes you here now, right? This is the standard equation. You don't change the equation for cold dark matter. So you still have the usual second order differential equation.
Well, but when you substitute for phi plus, in fact, does
that? Yeah, these were the equations that were dynamical. But if you go to the sub-horizon, you have to do something. So but still, the effect kind of comes through this scale, which is giving you a transition. So basically, what happens is that if you look at modes that are larger than the Compton wavelength, that rescaling factor is basically 1 over f, which is close to 1, as the fr, the derivative of f with respect to r, is very small. So nothing changes that much, which said in other words, could be that the scalarum is massive, so the fixed force is exponentially suppressed. And the shear contributed by the modification is 0, and the potentials are basically the same. But as you cross to scales, very small, probably at the end of the day, but below the Compton wavelength of the scalarum, then there you could see some departure from the standard behavior. You could see that the Newton constant tends to the scaling factor of 4 over 3. There is the shear which is contributing a slip between the potentials, so the potential tends to this low curvature solution of psi equal to phi. And the overall effect is that there is an enhancement in the growth, which we think is associated with the fact that the scalarum on this scale is none, so the fifth fault, the fifth force is acting. And we can see that if we do the simulations. So again, I'm plotting things for the same model. W effective constant equal to minus 1, and FR0 equal to 10 to the minus 4. So here, this diagonal dashed left-hand is the contour wavelength of the spiral. So you see today, that would be the value. But we are using a model that wouldn't satisfy, strictly speaking, the local constraints of gravity. So I guess it would be a lower value if we really look at it more today, or the smaller equivalent to the minus 6. So here I'm plotting basically the growth factor for cold dark matter, or if you want, using the Poisson equation, after all, this is just the transfer function for phi plus, as a function of scale on the vertical axis and redshift. The right family corresponds to lambda CDM. So you see what is stabilized, that matter grows linearly with the scale factor between matter dominations, and then it grows slowly. Or equivalently, potentials
are constant and starts decaying. But the important feature is that this is scale independent. And if you go to F of R, now you see that on scales larger than the Compton wavelength, so in this region, you kind of reproduce the standard behavior. But as you cross below the scale, then there is an enhancement. From the color code, you can see even that the matter here in this region tends to grow more faster. And potential basically would grow. It's a very narrow region, correspond to scales that are below the Compton wavelength during matter domination. And you can see that also if you cross-correlate basically the ISW with delta with galaxy, which is we are cross-correlating the time behavior of the potential phi plus with the clustering of dark matter. Again, in lambda CDM, you don't expect any cross-correlation during matter domination because potentials are constant, so zero signal. And then you expect a positive correlation, which I believe is spin detected up to redshift 1.5, more or less, for positive cross-correlation. Now, if you turn to F of R, again, besides introducing this scale dependence, you see that we would have some negative cross-correlation, which corresponds to the region in which the growth is enhanced and the potentials are growing. So a characteristics feature would be this, first of all, an integrated Saxwell signal during matter domination, but then also the negative cross-correlation with galaxy. So.
Mm-hmm. I think it seems important that you consider a model that really satisfies all of them, because at the end of the day, what matters is where those features come up at what scale. So for example, in that example, if I just look at it, at redshift 5, the density of the universe is basically the local density in the galaxy,
mm-hmm.
right? You can see the wavelength of your field is a megaparsec. So it's saying that in a galaxy, right now, this field has come to the wavelength of a megaparsec. So I would expect it grossly violates.
Yeah.
I mean, it's related to 10 to the minus 4, maybe. But
yeah, definitely. It changes if you go to 10 to the minus 6. But still, you should see. You should be able to see like having this negative cross correlation. I think even if you go to 10 to the minus 6, it changes on which scales and at which redshifts.
Well, the question is, I guess, the first galaxies that form, they're going to be small, and is this effect important to destroy the formation in some aspect?
Yeah.
But I guess you don't really understand the formation of first galaxies.
Yeah, that's something, first of all. And yes, you do show me
something. Is that right? Or is that what you're asking? Because, I mean, we don't really know much about galaxies of first five.
So, is there a simple way to understand how that, like, how those fine modes that you change up are such a bar with it?
I don't have any. Oh, okay.
Somebody needs to scale on some simple way.
So, what you're trying to do, if you try to satisfy the local constraints, you're trying to make the scalar more massive,
right?
So you're kind of decreasing its quantum wavelength. Now, I don't know how much an order of 10 to the minus, like two orders of minus to change in zero. I don't know exactly how much it will move this line and where it will move exactly this. It will for sure move it upward and make it smaller, but yeah, I don't have a precise number.
Am I right to think that if you did that too, that the change in those lines would be less pronounced?
Still, at least, if not changing the cross-correlation signal of I study and galaxy to negative, still, I guess, what you could see probably once you impose the local constraints is at least a reduction in the a zeroing of the cross-correlation. Yeah, probably you are not able to really go to negative significantly.
So, since there is this peculiar behavior of the potentials, in the recent literature, some parameters were proposed to try to study in a more generic kind of model-independent way modified gravity. Like, we see that f of r changes significantly the ratio between the potentials and the difference between the potentials. So Caldwell and collaborators introduced this parameter omega bar as the fractional difference in the potentials. And Zhang and collaborator introduced this parameter as the ratio of the two Newtonian potentials. To try to, try to introduce this parameter as probe of gravity, because what we would expect for lambda CDM, for example, for standard GR, or also for quintessence model of dark energy, like models in which dark energy doesn't cluster significantly, it doesn't carry any shear, any isotropic stress, you would expect eta to be 1 and curly pi to be 0. So basically here instead you see, for example, in f of r, we have a clearly scale-dependent pattern, and eta starts off as 1, but then tends to the value 1/2. And curly pi starts off as 0, but then increases to a constant, to an order unity value. So it's interesting. These are interesting parameters. But what is interesting about this parameter is the characteristic scale dependence, I guess.
I think the main feature of this theory is that, so like if you have quintessence or lambda CDM in which these things are 1, the ratio, for example, is 1, and the difference is 0, after all, what he's telling you is that psi, for example, is what is telling you about the clustering of polar matter, right? And psi plus phi is what's telling you, for example, about weak lensing. So in lambda CDM, they are exactly the same object, or in quintessence. After all, you're able to measure just that. So for example, instead, if you try to look at weak lensing, learn from some probes, I don't know, from weak lensing about the combination phi plus psi, and using, for example, redshift space distortion, using the velocity fields to learn just about psi, you can try to constrain these parameters. Okay, so just to conclude, it's interesting to try to do the following. Instead of thinking of the modification as changing the Einstein tensor, let's just move all the modification to the right-hand side and think that there are some sort of effective fluid. I'm still remaining in the Jordan frame, so it's not the scalar field of the Einstein frame, so it is separately conserved with respect to matter fields, and it's not really an independent source, because I'm moving it, it had a kind of geometrical origin, so it is strictly related to what the perturbation in the metric are doing. But it's just to try to get some insight, see how this effective field would behave. So first of all, it would have a shear, you see. It would have an isotropic stress contributing to the slip between the potentials. And then,
what happens is that if we look at sub-horizons case, here I'm introducing a parameter Q, which is basically telling us if we are above or below the Compton wavelength. So Q much smaller means that our wavelength is much larger than the Compton one. So on those scales, this basically this effective fluid would behave as a subdominant clustering component. But as we go below the Compton wavelength, then the sound speed turns to a negative value, minus two-thirds, and the ratio of the density perturbation in this effective fluid and in matter tends to values of -1/3. So you tend to see kind of voids of this effective fluid in correspondence of overdense region of cold dark matter. And -2/3 is a negative value for the square of the sound speed, so it could raise some concern about the stability of the perturbations in this fluid. But we have to remember that it's a fluid characterized by an anisotropic stress. So after all, what is stabilizing the perturbation is the presence of this anisotropic stress. If you want to define some sort of anisotropic stiffness parameter, this is the condition that you need to satisfy for the stability. And indeed, it's stable. That's what we see. Here I'm plotting the ratio of the Stilson model, the ratio of the density perturbation in this effective fluid with respect to cold dark matter. And you see that it starts off from zero and it tends to this negative value -1/3. So, concluding, we have reviewed the conditions that you need to impose on FOVAR theories in order to have a viable expansion history and to satisfy local constraints of gravity. And this reduces us to models that mimic closely the lambda CDM. So the degeneracy is really strong at the background level with the cosmological constant, but the prediction for the growth of structure is peculiar. It's introducing some scale-dependent pattern that may be on very small scales, might be detectable. So what happens is that this quantum, this scalar on this extra degree of freedom, is set in a scale. And on scales above this scale, the modifications are suppressed. We basically behave like in standard general relativity. But as we cross below the quantum wavelength, the enhancement due to the fifth force is evident. There is a slit contributed between the potentials. There is a rescaling of the Newton constant. And after all, the rate of growth for the perturbations depends on the balance between this enhancement, which is induced by the fifth force, and the acceleration of the universe once it kicks in. So we expect that the modification will have a maximized effect on scales that will be below the Compton wavelength during matter era. That's where we expect to see, for example, an integrated Saxwell signal and a negative cross-correlation with galaxy. So, but what is really peculiar is the behavior of phi plus. So perhaps as integrated Saxwell signal cannot get us to a very precise estimation of the value, then we can basically maybe resort to weak lensing surveys, which will give us a map of phi plus and maybe can tell us something about the behavior of gravity on large scales. And that's how I conclude.
This is the question here. So you were explaining it here, like, so you can think of that as sort of a local underdensity of the effective dark.
Yeah.
And yeah. Does that help you get? I mean, can you use that sort of to get intuition about how things will change? Like, since the sort of the local potential will be different, like, would you see something different, like in common?
So I think the fact that, so here it's here, right? I mean, it's a kind of negligible clustering. So it would tell you something like here in this region where it's sending to a negative and over one ratio. But I think that's correspondent. Basically, it's the effect of when you're below the. I think it's first of all an effect of the potentials will start diminishing, right? So I think it's kind of some sort of acceleration starting to kick in. So I don't know if it can really, at the end of the day, give you any useful insight in that sense.
Yeah.
In some of the models, in our models, we also did this dark fluid approach, so we took the combination as being a conserved thing. This is different, right?
Yeah, this is different. Okay. So it would be what you would do for a FOVR if you got one set effect. Then right. With the combination of right. Matter and the scalar field to be in conserved together, right? So it's, yeah, it doesn't have a very specific physically. It was just trying to gain some insight, like if we think of the modification as coming from fluid. Yeah.
The quantum wavelength of the field, maybe I lost something in the way, but how is, so why is that that value? And I would generally expect the Hubble length, the Hubble mass, but it's not right that, it's a bit smaller.
It's small, yeah. No, the quantum wavelength is smaller. It's basically from, it comes from the, if you have, okay, so typically you have Hubble scale, for example, for quintessence models, where you don't have any problem of fit force, right? In these models, you have a problem with fit force if you want to suppress it in order to don't have deviation from GR, for example, in local systems, then you need your scalar weather to be massive. And that's what is going to lower your quantum wavelength.
Yeah, but anyway, the quantum wavelength is anyway much bigger than the solar system. So this is not really solving the problem. I mean, you're solving the problem by turning down the coupling, if I understand.
No, you cannot.
What?
The coupling is a kind of, so if you want the Manstein frame, it's a sort of scalar tensor theory, but in which the coupling is fixed. So the only thing you can do to save yourself from the test local constraints is changing the mass, making this scalar field massive. Scalar tensor theory, you can save yourself by changing the coupling, for example, making it smaller. But in FOVR, it's fixed and universal.
The quantum wavelength, what is the quantum wavelength of your field?
Like value?
Yeah.
So it depends. It depends on your FOVR, first of all.
But megaparsecs still.
Yeah, and I don't remember the names of the other two, just recently published this paper in which they put some really numerical constraints, and I think the strongest was coming from the cross-correlation of ISW galaxy, and it was reducing this quantum wavelength to order 10 megaparsecs.
So how does one measure this ISW independently? Doesn't it mix in with a whole bunch of other effects?
Well, yeah, if you want to really talk just from the CMB power spectrum, there's not much hope. So typically that's why you cross-correlate with galaxies, because the disintegrated subset is coming from the change in the potential, so you think it should be correlated to the clustering of dark matter. So that's what you resort to. Otherwise, I think, yeah, reading it from the CMB.
So you look in particular areas on the sky? And
So how do you actually see this ISW effect? It's not from the CMB then?
Yeah, it's an effect from the CMB, in the sense that photons that are traveling, we know that photon entering a potential wave gains energy and exiting loses energy, right? If this potential wave is constant, nothing happens. It gains and loses the same energy. But if the potential is changing, either giving or becoming less steep, then you can gain or lose energy.
Right.
So it's typically what you see in the lower multiples of the CMB, it's changing the pulse in these lower multiples.
So are you saying that the other contributions to the fluctuations don't correlate at all with the galaxy,
yeah.
And that's why combination
yeah.
is the right thing to do?
Yeah, should let you isolate the integrated substrate.
Right, it should just be primordial. If it's just, if there's no, if it's a nearby clustering hasn't done anything, then you shouldn't see any correlation at all.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. If it's just a primordial.
So you take that from galaxy, then that would stand.
Yeah, for example,
you get the correlation.
Yeah, so it's like a physical thing, like there's a galaxy, do I see it?
Yeah, I think the last.
You mean, do you, you see a correlation with the CMB. If you do, you attribute it to the ISW.
Yes.
There's no
other. Yeah, I think the last instructions one was coming by cross-correlating that result from WMAP in the Sloan digital space unit. I think it went up to 1.5 inversion.
And then I have another question. When you chose your initial conditions,
yeah,
where are they actually coming from?
Because
I mean, you have to go back to an earlier time. I mean, that implies having chosen some earlier initial conditions.
Yeah, that's
so is there some, you
yeah,
think it's a natural choice, or is it a very fast choice?
Maybe a lazy choice in the sense of not having to deal with radiation. So we try to balance between going early on, where really modifications are totally negligible, but also trying to keep, for the sakeness of like simplicity, keep radiation of the simulation. And so that was the balance for the choice of the redshift.
Yeah, I see. But I mean, can you say whether those initial conditions, in some sense, are high probability or low probability? I mean, really, physically, you would have to set the initial conditions at an earlier time. I don't know if there's inflation in here.
You can use
at the end of inflation or something
sorry.
Like that.
No, but you can use, for example, you have the initial condition after the inflations if you want. But then you can use standard GR to evolve them using the transfer function or whatever you have for standard GR to evolve them to the stretch that you choose. So basically it's kind of a matching.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm asking how fine tuned.
Or anyhow, I think we just did a plain
I think maybe one answer. You're assuming something about your initial background, like
mm-hmm.
You're in a state close to GR, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's an, I think that's an attractor solution. You know?
Oh, that's your attractor?
Yeah,
so
in terms of the scalar field, there's a minimum, so
oh, yeah.
You'll be attracted to that stable point.
Yeah.
But you're not really solving a coincidence problem here.
No. In which no.
So I mean, there's still somewhere that's going to be fine tuning.
It's not a question about what redshift, it's a question about the choice of the numbers that you pick.
Yeah, if it's actually, yeah, but if you see we didn't choose, it was, so indeed you cannot read really any real numerical prediction of these plots because for initial condition, we didn't really choose any number, right? I don't know, setting something to 10 to the minus 5 is really, what did I have? Really off in CMB, but we are just basically rescaling everything by the initial value of 5 plus. So I'm not really choosing any specific, I'm just setting 5 plus initially equal to minus 1. So
I think Justin answered it. He said that choice of initial conditions you made was somehow attractive, somehow, no matter what you choose earlier on.
Because if you're in the GR solution, right, here in this minimum, I like to think about it in terms of minimum, then you're in the GR limit,
mm-hmm.
and that's an attractor. And then setting chi to zero,
chi.
Then that's the right thing.
Yeah, it's a safe thing to do. It's really, yeah, that's true. It's a, yeah, chi is set to zero, yeah.
And the rest of it is also an attractor?
Yeah. Well,
it's not equals minus 1.
5 plus equals minus 1, I mean, it's just, how can I say, I mean, it's just basically what we are looking and we are evolving is the ratio of how 5 plus changes with respect to some initial value. So that's the choice of minus 1. I don't think we are doing any, we are not trying to, fit to any data, so we are not trying to set it to the right specific initial conditions. And then these ones are just the conditions that you have by asking adiabatic initial perturbations on super horizon.
So I think this is what Lena asked us, so what is FFR, you don't know?
I don't have any specific form yet. We can rebuild it numerically, then from that solving that second order differential equation. So I can rebuild f of r if you want the potential for the Einstein frame scalar field. But yeah, I don't have any specific f of r. There are some.
Wait a minute, you do have one. You just don't have an analytic form for it, right?
Yeah. No, I can. Yeah.
You could plot.
Yeah, I could plot. Yeah.
So how much do your results or your conclusions change if you change sort of the background cosmology that Doug Forest is tracking? Right, so you chose that Lombardi to a background evolution that was exactly equal to Landis and Neolithic.
Mm-hmm.
Suppose you shifted the equation of state that you were tracking. How much would that shift your plots relative to the difference between the media? Right? So you have a difference in structure formation between your FMR and lambda CDM.
Yes.
But if I just change the background evolution, relatively speaking, how much does that shift things? Is there a degeneracy in the parameters?
There might be, although I think if you change the background evolution, then of course you're telling me that you want to compare it with something less sense.
But that theory is actually ruled out.
Yeah, there is
not W is minus 1.
What's that?
That theory is ruled out as soon as W is not minus 1.
Yeah.
Because the local test can strain it so much that you're forced to W is going to be minus 1.
Oh, I see. So there's
no
measure.
There's
no time
depends. Yeah, you can't.
No,
look, there is, but it's. You can't.
Very fine.
So if you measure W is not minus 1, then you know it's.
Rule out.
And what about minus 0.95?
No, still, even constant, equal to minus 0.95.
I think the deviation is probably like order 10 to minus 6, right? Or something.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Right, that's the only thing, yeah. That's basically its relation, yeah.
So you could just kill all these FFR models.
If you are able to detect W different than minus 1 significantly,
wow.
Yeah. Yeah. That might be an interesting
question. Can you rethink that? If you can manage any background, how can you show that W has to be minus 1?
I think the point is that W equals minus 1 is also tied to matching the solar system density.
Is that it? Yeah, I mean, you have some conditions already from the whole reproducing the right expansion history, but after all, the stringent constraint comes from when you ask, I want to satisfy local constraints.
Yeah.
Otherwise, yeah, you can have some sort of changing W, even crossing from smaller than minus 1 to bigger than minus 1.
Yeah, because the point is that to get satisfied local tests locally, the scalar field or the what she called the F comma R has to be very small locally.
Yeah.
And then to get the W not minus 1, you want that field to be M Planck on a cosmological scale. But you can't accommodate such a big gradient from local. It's maybe zero locally and you want M Planck in the cosmos. That's just too large a gradient.
Yeah.
Mm.
Too large.
Yeah,
it
take you off of there.
For what?
If you want to have a high Hamilton solution, it will take you off. You will not satisfy. Basically, you have a Yukawa correction to the potential, which is significant.
Which is bigger than the fifth force?
Yeah.
So this is on the model dependence section, what you're saying? This is model?
Yeah, it's an model. Yeah, it's a.
You would think it would. You would think it'd be possible to come up with some kind of behavior that would allow that, right? I mean, it's that function, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's got to be model dependent to some.
See, I think it would allow you to change this in a very narrow region of W, so kind of not dependent.
I think this was answered already, but I didn't really understand. So you say you don't know what FFR is. The free function you put in is the background, and that's the equivalent of FFR? I mean, you have some free function.
Yes,
yeah,
so maybe you can explain, yeah.
Model.
So maybe I should have said something that I didn't say. So we fixed expansion history, right?
Mm.
And then we solve this equation in order to begin as a function of R. And solutions, basically you have a growing mode and a decay mode. You set the initial amplitude of decay mode to zero because you don't want that. And then you're left with the free parameter, which is the amplitude, the initial amplitude of this growing mode for y. And that's the free parameter of the theory. So basically for any expansion history, you have a family of a FOVAR, which would reproduce that expansion. So it seems that you have a deep freedom. But actually, that initial amplitude is strictly correlated to that it's constrained by all these conditions, especially by the last one. So at the end of the day, you have a very small number of choices for a FOVAR, if you want. So the freedom is kind of reduced. Yeah.
time to ask for all questions.